This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On the screen, comedian John Hodgman has played a correspondent for The Daily Show, a deranged billionaire, and, of course, Mr. PC.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC, and I'm headed to the future.
What? The future, really?
Yes, Mac. Throughout human history, PCs have had to deal with freezing, crashing, error messages. I need to know if we're ever going to work the way we should. So I'm going to the year 2150.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, good luck. I hope it works. Greetings, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC. What? Future PC. Have they figured out how to fix our issues? Have they figured out how to make us as stable and as hassle-free as a Mac?
Future PC just froze.
Well, that answers that question.
These days, John Hodgman describes himself as a weird 44-year-old mustachioed dad. He has a new one-man show called Vacation Land in which he comes to grips with his identity, this new identity, and he gets older and older as life gets a little weirder and weirder. John Hodgman is going to be at the Carolina Theater in Durham on Saturday, October 24th at 8 o'clock. But first, he joins me from Vancouver. John Hodgman, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to talk with you.
How do you do? It's such a pleasure to be here. You know, I remember distinctly making that specific ad and where the PC goes 50 years into the future. And during one of the takes, I got out of the time machine and I said, you got to be kidding me. You're still making these ads 50 years into the future? A big laugh in the room.
That's great.
And what they didn't realize was I was hoping it would be true. I wish we would make them for 100 years into the future. But unfortunately, Apple realized that time moves on and that I am not immortal. And so I have learned that myself and I have moved on with my life as well.
You have. And we sort of dipped into the time machine ourselves to go back and find that thing in the vault. But it's great. And it does really – it kind of gives us a scope of your career. We've known you for a long time. I mean, the fact that you were doing that commercial – I mean, we already knew you. That's why you were the perfect guy for that commercial. I mean
– No one knew me. You know, the truth is that my career on camera was – happened very quickly and really implausibly. In 2005, 10 years ago, I brought out a book of fake trivia and invented amazing true facts called The Areas of My Expertise. And I promoted it on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And a couple months later, in January of 2006, he asked me back to be a contributor to the show. And only a couple months after that, I was asked to audition for these ads and I got them. And suddenly, in my then mid-30s, I went from being a professional writer, which is to say someone who rarely put on clothes and certainly did not need to look good on camera, to this weird round-faced man baby with a lazy eye who should not be on-camera talent. And yet I've managed to stay with it ever since.
Well, had that been a goal of yours? Had that been something you wanted to do?
Well, I mean, I love to perform and I am an incredible ham and I really love movies and television and that culture as well. But by the time I was in my mid-30s, I figured my chance had long passed for me to do that. And so my one ambition in life was to continue to write made-up facts and fake lists of, say, the 9 U.S. presidents who had hooks for hands and that sort of thing. And I ended up getting to write 3 more books of fake facts and invented truths until I realized that I was out of fake facts. And now if I wanted to continue to perform live on stage and in person, I would need to come up with something new to do. And what was left to me, unfortunately, was only the loathsome truth that I'm now a 44-year-old man, as you say, with a mustache that sends an evolutionary signal to the world that I'm all done or nearly done. It lets the mating pool know that I have passed on my genetic material. So no thank you to physical affection. It's time for me to focus on learning World War II trivia and crying at commercials and other weird dad hobbies like that.
Which brings us to Vacation Land. Tell us about that show.
Yeah. Well, so Vacation Land is my second big one-man show of monologues that are basically personal true stories about my life as an actual human being with an actual family and 2 human children. And we're very lucky in that I have long been marginally self-employed. My wife is a high school teacher and my children are unemployable deadbeats basically. So we've had a lot of chance to go away in the summer to the land of my birth, which is New England, specifically rural western Massachusetts, where my mom had a house. And when she passed away a long time ago, my wife and I took it over. And I'm a city kid, so my encounters with the country – and this is a true countryside. This is not tourist country out there in western Massachusetts. It's dairy farms and people looking at you funny. And my encounters with the country were hard and weird and ridiculous. including profound anxiety attacks that I would have as I was taking my garbage to the dump, because technically we weren't allowed to dump our garbage at that particular dump. And my 15-year fear that I was going to be called on this and be put in dump jail at any time. I've finally gotten over that. But just after I got over it, we started spending more and more time instead in Maine, which is a place where my wife has family. And Maine, of course, is known as vacation land, which is a cruel joke because it is the home of the most painful beaches on earth. And yet people still go there, including us. And a lot of the story is about me making peace, as we all have to, with various life transitions of leaving one career or one place in your life and going to an uncomfortable place, whether that is an uncomfortable new job or an uncomfortable new relationship or a literally uncomfortable place where the beaches are jagged rocks and the water is made of hate.
Made of hate, you say?
Well, the oceans of Maine are traumatically cold, such that it's hard not to take it personally.
But here, I mean, people do. It is called vacation land, and I guess so. People,
but
do
even
go
you know,
there.
But scientists, sure, they do. They go there, but you know, we've discovered places that are nice to go for vacation. I mean, look at the Outer Banks of the Carolinas.
Sure.
Gorgeous, warm,
full of love.
You go there. You go to the Outer Banks because something in you believes in your heart that you deserve happiness. But those of us who simply can't believe that go to Maine. Those of us who believe we don't deserve pleasure go to Maine and some of the harder places to recreate. And if you feel like you don't deserve pleasure in life, Maine is there to say you're right, and I'm going to confirm it.
What do the Mainers think about this? Because they have very particular ideas about their place. And I suspect people who come from the outside, I'm guessing, you know, initially there's some suspicion. And then here you come. And not only that, you've confirmed many of their suspicions.
The year-round population of Maine is an angry group of people. and I don't blame them, because they spend 10 months in cold and darkness and they endure. And then as soon as their home becomes tolerable for the first 5 minutes, all of a sudden – all of us jerks from the South show up and start demanding fudge and lobster rolls and make them work during their – it's the only time they can make money, but it's also the only time that their place is really in its most glorious moment. And so there's a lot of resentment. And so a lot of my stories are about the tension between me and the year-round residents and how they would rather you – vomit on the front steps of their establishment, then let you use the bathroom. That's the kind of that's what it's you know the on the license plates it says vacation land. What it should say is Maine, putting the spite in hospitality since 1820.
And yet you go back.
Yes, it becomes a kind of addiction. I mean, you know, there's a Stockholm syndrome aspect to it.
I see.
You know, you come to empathize with your torturer, but also, you know, there is something to surviving a hard experience that makes it more memorable. And this is true whether you are going to Maine as a 44-year-old dude with a family, or whether you endure some other hardship in your life. You know, the whole thing started when my mom passed away in 2000, very suddenly and very unexpectedly and very scarringly. And what happens when you go through something like that is you feel a tremendous sadness and you feel like it'll never be better again. And then you survive. And it's very similar to going swimming in Maine. You go swimming in Maine. Every cell in your body yells at you until finally their protests become numb as they all die of hypothermia. And you realize that you're floating in there and you can endure it. And then you actually kind of grow to like it. You get used to almost anything so long as it doesn't kill you. And that's sort of the gift of a Maine vacation.
I see.
It reminds you. Yeah. I mean, in this way, Maine is a metaphor. Do you know what I mean? Which is great, because that means if you get everything you need from the metaphor of Maine, you don't actually have to go there.
Just go see vacation land and you'll get the whole idea. But let's talk about this transition, this big change in your life. Sure, you're getting older. You've got a family. That's always an emblem that, you know, things are moving on. But you still got a career. I mean, you do have you really haven't had to leave that behind.
Well,
here you are, right?
I should call you every week, Frank. Thank you very much. That's very reassuring.
Well, here you are.
This is the most therapeutic interview I've ever had. Thank you.
I mean, Vancouver, Durham, look at you all over the place.
That's right. Orlando, Florida.
There you go.
Orlando also calls itself Vacation Land. Yeah. So that's on Friday the 22nd. If anyone happens to be listening to this as a podcast, go see me in Florida on the 22nd and watch Maine fight its evil twin, Orlando.
There is a contrast there. Quite a contrast, and yet for probably for very different reasons, neither one is that attractive. So, but now tell me about again the idea of you
well,
doing.
Well, I just want everyone to hear. I just want to hear all the shade. I want to point out all the shade that Frank just threw on Orlando, Florida there.
Oh, yeah.
Saying it was unpleasant.
I did.
The real thrill, of course, is that I get to come to Durham, North Carolina and the Research Triangle yet again. I love performing in North Carolina. And the Carolina Theater is, oh, boy, what a great place to be.
What about performing, though? Again, we talked about it just very briefly early on in this conversation. I mean, the idea that you really sort of thought you were a ham, but you hadn't really expected to have a career. Then you were on camera, and we still know who you are. And even the deranged billionaire, you're still out there as the deranged billionaire. Tell us how you came up with that character.
Well, it actually came up when I did a series of videos with They Might Be Giants, the band, who were acquaintances at the time. I'd been huge fans. And they needed a character to provide sort of linking narration for a series of songs that they had written. And I came up with this idea that I would be, at that point, a deranged millionaire, merely a deranged millionaire, who had a beef with They Might Be Giants. And I challenged them to this impossible task of making all these videos. And this was during a time before I had gone on The Daily Show, before it seemed like I would ever have a career in television. I would have been lucky if I were a deranged thousandaire at that time. But what happened was that after I went on TV, and especially with the Apple ads, I had been a freelance magazine writer and occasional public radio personality up until that point. There was no way I was going to be able to feed my family. It was not going to happen. We were going to have to leave New York and find someplace else and start over, and I would have to get a real job. When all of a sudden television came in and rescued us from financial oblivion, and so the first time in my life I faced a possibility of financial security. I mean, I had a degree in literary theory. That's how bad it was, Frank. Not even a degree in literature. A degree in theory of literature would be too practical. I wanted to think about the idea of books. Yeah. And for some reason, no one was giving me a lot of money for that.
So you chose public radio. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I chose that's where the big pledge dollars are. What I mean?
Call now.
But, something very strange happened to me once I faced a new future of potential financial security, which is a lot of anxiety left me. A lot of the anxiety that I had lived with my entire life, and I'm a pretty anxious dude because I'm an only child. I'm a member of the Super Smart Afraid of Conflict Narcissist Club. I'm constantly terrified that I'm going to break a rule and someone isn't going to love and approve me all the time. But all that anxiety went away the moment that I had financial security, and it was a real eye opener. And it's not something they want to talk to you about in American culture. In American culture, they want to say it doesn't matter how much money you have; you can be happy. Well, I can tell you, it's a lot easier to be happy when you're not worried about if you're going to make your nut this year. And how much therapy is gone through in this country simply because people live in a perpetual state of economic anxiety. It's a dirty secret that wealth conveys a stability. And I think that's why there are certain people and certain politicians in this country who would prefer to keep the electorate out of the middle class and in a state of perpetual economic anxiety, because people tend to act and vote out of fear and that kind of.
Well, it does that, and sadly, the people who are the most anxious and the most insecure in that way, the most economically insecure, can't even afford the therapy, and so they self-medicate. And those self-medications are available to them are demonized and criminalized.
Precisely.
And those particular therapies and remedies that are available to the rich, which is an addiction to money, we glorify. So that becomes kind of compounds the problem, doesn't it?
Look, Frank, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And luckily for me, when I sought therapy in my life as a younger man, I went to a deep discount therapeutic office. It was a pay what you will, because they were training therapists there. So it was like barber school for therapy. And people say, oh, no, discount therapy, that must have been terrible. I'm like, no, you should go get it if you can, because the truth is the markup on retail therapy is insane. Being able to talk in a room, giving yourself permission to talk in a room about everything that's scaring you is a gift unto itself. Having another person in the room is almost just a, like, gravy. Do you know what I mean? You might as well have a stand-up cardboard cutout of Captain Kirk over there and get a lot out of it all the same.
But you've made – I mean, your characters, the deranged billionaire, grandiose characters, the expert, the sort of
yeah,
pro-expert.
Yeah, it's fun. Like, I always would say about the PC, it's fun to play the villain. He wasn't the villain. Do you know what I mean? But he was – like all of those characters, the deranged billionaire, the resident expert, he was a guy who thought he had all the answers but in fact had very few answers. And he would simply spout authoritative nonsense with a straight face and get away with it. And that's such a fun thing to do. You know, as the resident expert on The Daily Show, I could say monstrous things about how, you know, the economics, you know, is known as the dismal science. And it's known as the dismal science because it was named for Sir Eustace Dismal, the British economist who in the 18th century first proposed making industrial smokestacks out of children. And the reason that it didn't go forward was because if you made the smokestacks out of children, who would you use to clean the smokestacks? So you could say terrible, terrible things and get away with it in this straight face that might be funny and also sort of illuminate how we think about things.
Well, and horribly plausible. I'm talking to John Hodgman today on The State of Things. Plausible, I guess, is the other scary thing about all of that. The modest proposal is suddenly
precisely
something that now, we can get back to Vacation Land for just a moment, the show you're going to do in Durham. You call it white privilege mortality comedy. And I'm just wondering, aren't you worried that people will confuse you with the Republican National Convention?
I mean, I believe in truth and advertising is the thing. When you're up on stage and you're a white man in his 40s from Brookline, Massachusetts, and you are in another part of the world and you're talking about vacationing in Maine – you know, it's my true life story. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge what's going on here. You know, you have to check your privilege to some degree. And I do in the show. You know, I was telling some of these stories and I travel around a lot with my good friend, the musician John Roderick, who's actually sitting next to me during this very interview. And I was telling some of these stories and he got up to tune his guitar after to play some songs. And he said, "Well, I hope you all enjoyed the white privilege comedy of John Hodgman." I'm like, yeah, that stings, but harsh but fair. But I did correct him. I said it's not just the white privilege comedy of John Hodgman. It's the white privilege mortality comedy of John Hodgman, because it is about also my own preoccupation with endings of all kinds, including the final one. And that's why I am perhaps the highest paid children's performer in the world, because kids love to see a weird dude in a beard and mustache talk about summer homes in Maine and how he's afraid of dying.
Talk about your process too, because I know you had shows where you would just charge a really nominal amount and not even advertise them and do some real extemp kind of comedy, right?
Yeah, well, I had to start doing that because once my last book of complete fake world knowledge was published in 2012, That Is All, I realized that I didn't want to make those kinds of jokes anymore. And I realized that I also wanted to continue performing on stage. I'd really grown to love it. And so I had to come up with something new to do. And I, you know, figuring out as a creative person or just in one's everyday life what makes you happy, what you're interested in, what you're thinking about. Most of the time we're just distracting ourselves on our phones in order to pass the time. But to really think about what's on your mind, sometimes you have to trick yourself into writing a journal or in my case, going down into a basement beneath a bocce court in Brooklyn, New York, where I live, and charging a very small amount so no one would expect entertainment, and standing in front of a small audience and coming up with things to say, often just that day. And it often was just what I did that day. And it would suddenly reveal to me and the audience all sorts of realms of thought that I hadn't even been conscious of and preoccupations. What I realized what I really wanted to do was start telling true stories about myself as a real human being and hope and trust that the audience would not mind that I was no longer wearing a monocle and a tuxedo as the deranged millionaire, but wouldn't mind just seeing me, John Hodgman, the same John Hodgman that they hear on my podcast, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, the same John Hodgman that you see if you ever were to meet me. And so far, it's been really exciting and wonderful. And reassuring that humans don't hate me as me.
You will see all of that when you see Vacation Land with my guest, John Hodgman. John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
The pleasure is mine. Will you tell me again how I still have a career? Because I loved hearing that.
You still have a
just
career.
Just say it again. Say it again,
you
Frank.
You have a career, and it continues here in Durham, North Carolina, Saturday, October 24th at 8 o'clock, Vacation Land, John Hodgman. I'll say it again and again. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.